Volley had arrived 3 days before with a report full of fresh negatives. A handful of French dragons had arrived in Cadiz, enough to keep Mortiferous from forcing out the fleet, but not a tenth of the dragons which had been stationed along the Rhine. And in cause for more concern, even though nearly every light and quick dragon not wholly involved in dispatch service had been pressed into scouting and spying, they still knew nothing more of Bonaparte's work across the Channel. He walked with her to Exidium's clearing and saw her aboard. It was strange, for he felt as though he ought to feel more. He would have put a bullet in his brains sooner than let Edith go to face danger while he remained behind himself, yet he could say his adieus to Roland without much more of a pang than in bidding farewell to any other comrade. She blew him a friendly kiss from atop Exidium's back, once her crew were all aboard.
"I will see you in a few months, I'm sure, or sooner if we can chase the frogs out of harbour," she called down. "Fair winds, and mind you don't let Emily run wild."
He raised a hand to her.
"Godspeed,"
he called, and stood watching as the enormous wings carried Exidium up, the other dragons of his formation rising to join him, until they had all dwindled out of sight to the south. Although they kept a wary eye on the Channel skies, the first weeks after Exidium's departure were quiet. No raids came, and Lenton was of the opinion that the French still thought Exidium was in residence, and were correspondingly reluctant to make any venture.
"The longer we can keep them thinking it, the better," he said to the assembled captains after another uneventful patrol. "Aside from the benefit to us, just as well if they don't realize another formation is nearing their precious fleet at Cadiz."
They all took a great measure of comfort from the news of Exidium's safe arrival, which Volley brought almost 2 weeks to the day from his departure.
"They'd already begun when I left,"
Captain James told the other captains the next day, taking a hurried breakfast before setting out on his return journey.
"You could hear the Spaniards howling for miles. Their merchantmen are as quick to fall apart under dragon spray as any ship of the line, and their shops and houses as well. I expect they'll fire on the Frenchmen themselves if Villeneuve doesn't come out soon, alliance or not."
The atmosphere grew lighter after this encouraging news, and Lenton cut their patrol a little short and granted them all liberty for celebration, a welcome respite to men who had been working at a frenetic pace. The more energetic went into town, most seized a little sleep, as did the weary dragons. Lawrence took the opportunity to enjoy a quiet evening's reading with Temeraire. They stayed together late into the night, reading by the light of the lanterns. Lawrence woke out of a light doze some time after the moon had risen. Temeraire's head was dark against the illuminated sky, and he was looking searchingly to the north of their clearing.
"Is something the matter?" Lawrence asked him.
Sitting up, he could hear a faint noise, strange and high. Even as they listened, the sound stopped.
"Lawrence, that was Lily, I think," Temeraire said, his ruff standing up stiffly.
Lawrence slid down at once.
"Stay here. I will return as quickly as I may," he said,
and Temeraire nodded without ever looking away. The paths through the covert were largely deserted and unlit. Exidium's formation gone, all the light dragons out on scouting duty, and the night cold enough to send even the most dedicated crews into the barracks buildings. The ground had frozen 3 days before. It was packed, and hard enough for his heels to drum hollowly upon it as he walked. Lily's clearing was empty. A faint murmur of noise from the barracks, whose lit windows he could see distantly through the trees, and no one about the buildings. Lily herself was crouched, motionless, her yellow eyes red-rimmed and staring, and she was clawing the ground silently. Low voices, and the sound of crying. Lawrence wondered if he was intruding untimely, but Lily's evident distress decided him. He walked into the clearing, calling in a strong voice,
"Harcourt, are you there?"
"No further,"
came Choiseul's voice, low and sharp. Lawrence came around Lily's head and halted in dreadful surprise. Choiseul was holding Harcourt by the arm, and there was an expression of complete despair on his face.
"Make no sound, Lawrence," he said.
There was a sword in his hand, and behind him on the ground Lawrence could see a young midwingman stretched out, dark blood-stains spreading over the back of his coat.
"No sound at all."
"For God's sake, what do you think you are about?" Lawrence said. "Harcourt, is it well with you?"
"He has killed Will Poyse," she said thickly.
She was wavering where she stood, and as the torchlight came on her face, He could see a bruise already darkening across half her forehead.
"Lawrence, never mind about me. You must go and fetch help. He means to do Lily a mischief."
"No, never, never," Choiseul said. "I mean no harm to her or you, Catherine, I swear it. But I will not be answerable if you interfere, Lawrence. Do nothing."
He raised the sword. Blood gleamed on its edge, not far from Harcourt's neck, and Lily made the thin, eerie noise again, a high-pitched whining that grated against the ear. Choiseul was pale, his face taking on a greenish cast in the light, and he looked desperate enough to do anything. Lawrence kept his position, hoping for a better moment. Choiseul stood, staring at him a moment longer, until satisfied Lawrence did not mean to go, and then said,
"We will go all of us together to Precursoris. Lily, you will stay here, and follow when you see us go aloft. I promise you no harm will come to Catherine, so long as you obey."
"Oh, you miserable, cow-hearted traitor dog," Harcourt said. "Do you think I am going to go to France with you and lick Bonaparte's boots? How long have you been planning this?"
She struggled to pull away from him, even staggering as she was, but Choiseul shook her and she nearly fell. Lily snarled, half rising, her wings mantling. Lawrence could see the black acid glistening at the edges of her bone spurs.
"Catherine," she hissed,
the sound distorted through her clenched teeth.
"Silence! Enough!"
Choiseul said, pulling Harcourt up and close to his body, pinning her arms. The sword still held steady in his other hand, Lawrence's eyes always upon it, waiting for a chance.
"You will follow, Lily. You will do as I have said. We are going now. March, at once, monsieur, there!"
He gestured with the sword. Lawrence did not turn around, but stepped backwards, and once beneath the shadow of the trees he moved more slowly still, so that Choiseul came unknowingly closer than he meant to do. A moment of wild grappling, then they all three went to the ground in a heap, the sword flying and Harcourt caught between them. They struck the ground heavily, but Choiseul was beneath, and for a moment Lawrence had the advantage. He was forced to sacrifice it, to roll Harcourt free and out of harm's way, and Choiseul struck him across the face as soon as she was clear, throwing him off. They rolled about on the ground, battering at each other awkwardly, both trying to reach for the sword even as they struggled. Choiseul was powerfully built and taller, and though Lawrence had a far greater experience of close combat, the Frenchman's weight began to tell as they wrestled. Lily was roaring out loud now, voices calling in the distance, and despair gave Choiseul a burst of strength. He drove a fist into Lawrence's stomach and lunged for the sword while Lawrence curled, gasping about the pain. Then there was a tremendous roaring above them. The ground shuddered, branches tumbling down in a rain of dry leaves and pine needles, and an immense old tree was wrenched whole out of the ground beside them. Temeraire was above them, beating wildly as he tore away the cover. More bellowing, now from Precursoris. The French dragon's pale, marbled wings were visible in the dark, approaching, and Temeraire writhed around to face him, claws stretching out. Lawrence dragged himself up and threw himself onto Choiseul, bearing him down to the ground with all his weight. He was retching even as they struggled, but Temeraire's danger spurred him on. Choiseul managed to turn them over and force an arm against Lawrence's throat, pressing hard, choking. Lawrence caught only a glimpse of motion, and then Choiseul went limp. Harcourt had fetched an iron bar from Lily's gear and struck him upon the back of the head. She was nearly fainting with the effort, Lily trying to crowd between the trees to reach her. The crew were rushing into the clearing now at last, however, and many hands helped Lawrence up to his feet.
"Stand over that man there. Bring torches," Lawrence said, gasping. "And get a full-voiced man here with a speaking trumpet. Hurry, damn you!"
For above, Temeraire and Precursoris were still circling each other, claws flashing. Harcourt's first lieutenant was a big-chested man with a voice that needed no trumpet. As soon as he understood the circumstances, he cupped his hands around his mouth and bellowed up at Precursoris. The big French dragon broke off and flew in wild, desperate circles for a moment as he peered down to where Choiseul was being secured, and then with drooping head he returned to the ground, Temeraire hovering watchfully until he had landed. Maximus was housed not far off, and Berkeley had come to the clearing on hearing the noise. He took charge now, setting men to chain Precursoris, and others to bear Harcourt and Choiseul to the surgeons, still others to take away poor Wilpoise to be buried.
"No, thank you.
"I can manage," Lawrence said, shaking off the willing hands that would have carried him as well. His breathing was returning, and he walked slowly over to the clearing where Temeraire had landed beside Lily, to comfort both the dragons and try to calm them. Choiseul did not rouse for the better part of a day, and when he first woke he was thick-tongued and confused in his speech. Yet by the next morning he was once again in command of himself, and at first refused to answer any questions whatsoever. Precursoris had been ringed round by all the other dragons, and ordered to remain on the ground under pain of Choiseul's death. A threat to the handler was the one thing which could hold an unwilling dragon, and the means by which Choiseul had intended to force Lily to defect to France were now used against him. Precursoris made no attempt to defy the command, but huddled into a miserable heap beneath his chains, eating nothing and occasionally keening softly.
"Harcourt," Lenton said at last, coming into the dining-room and finding them all assembled and waiting. "I am damned sorry, but I must ask you to try. He has not spoken to anyone else, but if he has the honour of a yellow rat, he must feel some explanation owed you. Will you ask him?"
She nodded, and then she drained her glass, but her face stayed so very pale that Lawrence asked quietly, "Should you like me to accompany you?"
"Yes, if you please,"
she said at once, gratefully, and he followed her to the small, dark cell where Choiseul was incarcerated. Choiseul could not meet her gaze, nor speak to her. He shook his head and shuddered, and even wept as she asked him questions in an unsteady voice.
"Oh, damn you!"
she cried at last, crackling with anger.
How could you have a heart to do this? Every word you have said to me was a lie. Tell me, did you even arrange that first ambush on our way here? Tell me!"
Her voice was breaking, and he had dropped his face into his hands. Now he raised it and cried to Lawrence,
"For God's sake, make her go! I will tell you anything you like, only send her out!"
and dropped it back down again. Lawrence did not in the least want to be his interrogator, but he could not prolong Harcourt's suffering unnecessarily. He touched her on the shoulder, and she fled at once. It was deeply unpleasant to have to ask Choiseul questions, still more unpleasant to hear that he had been a traitor since coming from Austria.
"I see what you think of me,"
Choiseul added, noting the look of disgust on Lawrence's face.
"And you have a right. But for me there was no choice."
Lawrence had been keeping himself strictly to questions, but this paltry attempt at excuse inflamed him beyond his resistance. With contempt he said,
"You might have chosen to be honest, and done your duty in the place you begged of us."
Choiseul laughed, with no mirth in the sound.
"Indeed. And when Bonaparte is in London this Christmas time, what then? You may look at me that way if you like. I have no doubt of it. And I assure you, if I thought any deed of mine could alter that outcome, I would have acted. Instead, you have become a traitor twice over and helped him, when your first betrayal could only be excused if you had been sincere in your principles," Lawrence said.
He was disturbed by Choiseul's certainty, though he would never conceive of giving any sign as much.
"Ah, principles,"
Choiseul said. All his bravado had deserted him, and he seemed now only weary and resigned.
"France is not so under strength as are you, and Bonaparte has executed dragons for treason before. What do principles matter to me when I see the shadow of the guillotine hanging upon Precursoris? And where was I to take him? To Russia? He will outlive me by 2 centuries, and you must know how they treat dragons there. I could hardly fly him to America without a transport. My only hope was a pardon, and Bonaparte offered it only at a price."
"By which you mean Lily," Lawrence said coldly.
Surprisingly, Choiseul shook his head.
"No. His price was not Catherine's dragon, but yours."
At the blank look upon Lawrence's face, he added,
"The Chinese egg was sent as a gift for him from the imperial throne. He meant me to retrieve it. He did not know Temeraire was already hatched."
Choiseul shrugged and spread his hands.
"I thought perhaps if I killed him—"
Lawrence struck him full across the face, with such force as to knock him onto the stone floor of the cell. His chair rocked and fell over with a clatter. Choiseul coughed and blotted blood from his lip, and the guard opened the door and looked inside.
"Everything all right, sir?"
he asked, looking straight at Lawrence. He paid not the slightest mind to Choiseul's injury.
"Yes, you may go,"
Lawrence said flatly, wiping blood from his hand onto his handkerchief as the door closed once again. He would ordinarily have been ashamed to strike a prisoner, but in this moment he felt not the slightest qualm. His heart was still beating very quickly. Choiseul slowly set his chair back upright and sat down once more. More quietly he said,
"I am sorry. I could not bring myself to it in the end, and I thought instead—"
He stopped, seeing the colour rise again in Lawrence's face. The very notion that for all these months such malice had been lurking so close to Temeraire, averted only by some momentary quirk of conscience on Choiseul's part, was enough to make his blood run cold. With loathing, he said,
"And so instead you tried to seduce a girl barely past her schoolroom years and abduct her?"
Choiseul said nothing. Indeed, Lawrence could hardly imagine what defence he could have offered. After a moment's pause, Lawrence added,
"You can have no further pretensions to honour.
Tell me what Bonaparte plans, and perhaps Lenton will have Precursoris sent to the breeding grounds in Newfoundland, if indeed your motive is for his life and not your own miserable hide."
Choiseul paled, but said,
"I know very little, but what I know I will tell you. If he gives his word to do as much—"
"No," Lawrence said. "You may speak, and hope for a mercy you do not deserve if you choose. I will not bargain with you."
Choiseul bowed his head, and when he spoke he was broken, so faint Lawrence had to strain to hear him.
"I do not know what he intends, precisely. But he desires me to urge the weakening of the covert here most particularly, to have as many sent south to the Mediterranean as could be arranged."
Lawrence felt sick with dismay. This goal, at least, had been brilliantly accomplished.
"Does he have some means for his fleet to escape Cadiz?" he demanded. "Does he suppose he can bring them here without facing Nelson?"
"Do you imagine Bonaparte confided in me?" Choiseul said, not lifting his head. "To him also I was a traitor. I was told the tasks I was to accomplish. Nothing more."
Lawrence satisfied himself with a few more questions that Choiseul truly knew nothing else. He left the room feeling both soiled and alarmed, and went at once to Lenton. The news cast a heavy pall upon the whole covert. The captains had not broadcast the details, but even the lowliest cadet or crewman could tell that a shadow lay upon them. Choiseul had timed his attempt well. The dispatch rider would not reach them again for 6 days, and from there 2 weeks or more would be required to see any portion of the forces from the Mediterranean restored to the Channel. Militia forces and several army detachments had already been sent for. They would arrive within a few days to begin emplacing additional artillery along the coastline. Lawrence, with additional cause for anxiety, had spoken to Granby and Holland to raise their caution on Temeraire's behalf. If Bonaparte were jealous enough of having so personal a prize taken away, he might well send another agent, this one more willing to slay the dragon he could no longer claim.
"You must promise me to be careful," he told Temeraire as well. "Eat nothing unless one of us is by and has approved it. And if anyone whom I have not presented to you seeks to approach you, do not under any circumstances permit it, even if you must fly to another clearing."
"I will have a care, Lawrence, I promise," said Temeraire. "I do not understand, though, why the French Emperor should want to have me killed. How could that improve his circumstances? He would do better to ask them for another egg."
"My dear, the Chinese would hardly condescend to give him a second where the first went so badly astray while in the keeping of his own men," he said. "I am still puzzled at their having given him even one, indeed. They must have some prodigiously gifted diplomat at their court. And I suppose his pride may be hurt to think that a lowly British captain stands in the place which he had meant to occupy himself."
Temeraire snorted with disdain.
"I am sure I would never have liked him in the least, even if I had hatched in France," he said. "He sounds a very unpleasant person."
"Oh, I cannot truly say. One hears a great deal of his pride, but there is no denying that he is a very great man, even if he is a tyrant," Lawrence said reluctantly. He would have been a great deal happier to be able to convince himself that Bonaparte was a fool.
Lenton gave orders that patrols now were to be flown only by half the formation at a time. The rest kept back at the covert for intensive combat training. Under cover of night, several additional dragons were secretly flown down from the coverts at Edinburgh and Inverness, including Victoriatus, the Parnassian whom they had rescued what now seemed a long time ago. His captain, Richard Clark, made a nice point of coming to greet Lawrence and Temeraire. "I hope you can forgive me for not paying you my respects and my gratitude sooner," he said. "I confess, at Lagan I had very little thought for anything but his recovery, and we were shipped out again without warning, as I believe were you." Lawrence shook his hand heartily.
"Pray do not give it a thought," he said. "I hope he is wholly recovered?"
"Entirely, thank heaven. And none too soon, either," Clark said grimly. "I understand the assault is expected at any moment." And yet the days stretched out, painfully long with anticipation, and no attack came. Three more Winchesters were brought down for additional scouting, but one and all they returned from their dangerous forays to the French shores to report heavy patrols at all hours along the enemy's coastline. There was no chance of penetrating far enough inland to acquire more information. Levitas was among them, but the company was large enough that Lawrence was not obliged to see much of Rankin, for which he was grateful. He tried not to see the signs of that neglect which he could do no more to cure. He felt he could not visit the little dragon further without provoking a quarrel which might be disastrous to the temper of the whole covert. However, he compromised with his conscience, so far as to say nothing, when he saw Hollin coming to Temeraire's clearing very early the next morning, with a bucket full of dirty cleaning rags and a guilty expression. A great coldness settled over the camp as night came on Sunday, the first week of waiting gone. Volatilis had not arrived as expected. The weather had been clear, certainly no cause for delay. It stayed so for two further days, and then a third. Still he did not come. Lawrence tried not to look to the skies, and ignored his men doing the same, until that night he found Emily, crying quietly outside the clearing, having crept away from the barracks for a little privacy. She was very ashamed to be caught at it, and pretended there was only some dust in her eyes. Lawrence took her to his rooms and had some cocoa brought. He told her, "I was 2 years older than you are now when I first went to sea, and I blubbered at night for a week." She looked so very sceptical at this account that a laugh was drawn from him. "No, I'm not inventing this for your benefit," he said. "When you are a captain and find one of your own cadets in similar circumstances, I imagine you will tell them what I have just told you."
"I'm not really afraid," she said,
weariness and cocoa having combined to make her drowsy and unguarded.
"I know Exidium will never let anything happen to Mother, and he is the finest dragon in all Europe."
She woke up at having made this slip, and added anxiously,
"Temeraire is very nearly as good, of course."
Lawrence nodded gravely.
"Temeraire is a great deal younger. Perhaps he will equal Exidium some day, when he has more experience."
"Yes, just so,"
she said, very relieved, and he concealed his smile. 5 minutes later she was asleep. He laid her on the bed and went to sleep with Temeraire.
"Lawrence! Lawrence!"
He stirred and blinked upwards. Temeraire was nudging him awake urgently, though the sky was still dark. Lawrence was dimly aware of a low, roaring noise, a crowd of voices, and then the crack of gunfire. He started up at once. None of his crew were in the clearing, nor his officers.
"What is it?"
Temeraire asked, rising to his feet and unfurling his wings as Lawrence climbed down.
"Are we being attacked? I do not see any dragons aloft."
"Sir, sir!" Morgan came running into the clearing, nearly falling over himself in his haste and eagerness.
"Folly is here, sir, and there has been a great battle, and Napoleon is killed!"
"Oh, does that mean the war is over already?" Temeraire asked, disappointed. "I have not even been in any real battles yet."
"Perhaps the news may have grown in the telling. I shall be surprised to learn that Bonaparte is truly dead," Lawrence said.
But he had identified the noise as cheering, and certainly some good news had arrived, if not of quite such an absurd calibre.
"Morgan, go and rouse Mr. Hollin and the ground crew with my apologies for the hour, and ask them to bring Temeraire his breakfast. My dear," he said, turning to Temeraire, "I will go and learn what I can, and return with the news soonest."
"Yes, please, and do hurry,"
Temeraire said urgently, rearing up on his back legs to see above the trees what might be in progress. The headquarters was blazing with light, Volley was sitting on the parade grounds before the building, tearing ravenously into a sheep, a couple of groundsmen with the dispatch service keeping off the growing crowd of men streaming from the barracks. Several of the young army and militia officers were firing off their guns in their excitement, and Lawrence was forced to nearly push his way through to reach the doors. The doors to Lenton's office were closed, but Captain James was sitting in the officers' club, eating with scarcely less ferocity than his dragon, and already all the other captains were with him, having the news.
"Nelson told me to wait, said they'd come out of port before I had time to make another circuit," James was saying out of the corner of his mouth and somewhat muffled by toast, while Sutton attempted to sketch the scene on a piece of paper. "I hardly believed him, but sure enough, by Sunday morning out they came and we met them off Cape Trafalgar early on Monday."
He swallowed down a cup of coffee, all the company waiting impatiently for him to finish, and pushed his plate aside for a moment to take the paper from Sutton.
"Here, let me," he said, drawing little circles to mark the positions of the ships. 27 and 12 dragons of ours against 33 and 10.
"Two columns, breaking their line twice?" Lawrence asked,
studying the diagram with satisfaction. Just the sort of strategy to throw the French into disarray, from which their ill-trained crews could hardly have recovered.
"What? Oh, the ships, yes, with Exidium and Laetificat over the weather column, Mortiferous over the lee," James said. "It was hot work at the head of the division, I can tell you. I couldn't see so much as a spar from above for the clouds of smoke. At one time I thought for sure Victory had blown up. The Spanish had one of those blasted little Flecha del Fuegos over there, dashing about quicker than our guns could answer. He had all her sails on fire before Laetificat sent him running with his tail between his legs."
"What were our losses?" Warren asked,
his quiet voice cutting through the high spirits of their excitement. James shook his head. "It was a proper bloodbath and no mistake," he said somberly. "I suppose we have near 1,000 men killed, and poor Nelson himself came in a hair's breadth of it. The firebreather set alight one of Victory's sails, and it came down upon him where he stood on the quarter-deck. A couple of quick-thinking fellows doused him with a scuttle-butt, but they say his medals were melted to his skin, and he will wear them all the time now."
1,000 men. God rest their souls," Warren said.
Conversation ceased, and when finally resumed it was at first subdued. But excitement, joy, gradually overcame what perhaps were the more proper sentiments of the moment.
"I hope you will excuse me, gentlemen,"
Lawrence said, nearly shouting as the noise climbed to a fresh pitch. It precluded any chance of acquiring further intelligence for the moment.
"I promised Temeraire to return at once. James, I suppose that the report of Bonaparte's demise is a false one?"
"Yes, more's the pity, unless he falls down in an apoplexy over the news," James called back, which roused a general shout of laughter that continued by natural progression into a round of Hearts of Oak, and the singing followed Lawrence out the door and even through the covert, as the song was taken up by the men outside.
By the time the sun rose, the covert was half empty. Scarcely a man had slept. The prevailing mood could not help but be joyful, almost to the point of hysteria, as nerves which had been drawn to their limits abruptly relaxed. Lenton did not even attempt to call the men to order, and looked the other way as they poured out of the covert into the city to carry the news to those who had not yet heard, and mingle their voices into the general rejoicing.
"Whatever scheme of invasion Bonaparte has been working towards, this must surely have put paid to it," Chenery said exultantly later that evening, as they stood together on the balcony and watched the returning crowd still milling more slowly about in the parade grounds below. All the men thoroughly drunk, but too happy for quarrelling, snatches of song bursting out occasionally to float up towards them.
"How I should like to see his face!"
"I think we have been giving him too much credit," Lenton said.
His cheeks were red with port and satisfaction, as well they might be. His judgment to send Exidium had proven sound and contributed materially to the victory.
"I think it clear he does not understand the navy so well as the army and the aerial corps. An uninformed man might well imagine that 33 ships of the line had no excuse to lose so thoroughly to 27.
"But how can it have taken his aerial divisions so long to reach them?"
Harcourt said. "Only 10 dragons. And from what James said, more than half of those Spanish. That is not a tenth of the strength he had in Austria. Perhaps he has not moved them from the Rhine after all.
I have heard the passes over the Pyrenees are damn difficult, though I have never tried them myself," Chenery said. "But I dare say he never sent them, thinking Villeneuve had what forces he needed. And they have all been lolling about in covert and getting fat. No doubt he's been thinking all this time that Villeneuve would sail straight through Nelson, perhaps losing one or two ships in the process, expecting them daily and wondering where they were, and we here biting our nails meanwhile for no good reason. "And now his army cannot come across," Harcourt said. "Quoth Lord St. Vincent, I don't say they cannot come, but they cannot come by sea," Chennery said, grinning. "And if Bonaparte thinks to take Britain with 40 dragons and their crews, he is very welcome to try, and we can give him a taste of those guns the militia fellows have been so busily digging in. It would be a pity to waste all their hard work."
"I confess I would not mind a chance to give that rascal yet another dose of medicine," Lenton said. "But he will not be so foolish. We must be content with having done our duty, and let the Austrians have the glory of polishing him off. His hope of invasion is done."
He swallowed the rest of his port and said abruptly,
"There is no more putting it off, though, I am afraid. We cannot need anything more from Choiseul now."
In the silence that fell among them, Harcourt's drawn breath was almost a sob, but she made no protest, and her voice remained admirably steady as she merely asked,
"Have you decided what you will do with Precursorus?"
"We will send him to Newfoundland, if he will go. They need another breeding sire there to fill out their complement, and it is not as though he were vicious," Lenton said. "The fault is with Choiseul, not him."
He shook his head.
"It is a damned pity, of course, and all our beasts will be creeping about miserable for days, but there is nothing else for it. Best to get it done with, quickly, tomorrow morning."
Choiseul was given a few moments with Precursorus, the big dragon nearly draped with chains, and watched closely by Maximus and Temeraire on either side. Lawrence felt the shudders go through Temeraire's body as they stood their unpleasant guard, forced to observe, while Precursorus swung his head from side to side in denial, and Choiseul made a desperate attempt to persuade him to accept the shelter Lenton had offered. At last the great head drooped in the barest hint of a nod, and Choiseul stepped close to lay his cheek against the smooth nose. Then the guards stepped forward. Precursorus tried to lash at them, but the entangling chains pulled him back, and as they led Choiseul away, the dragon screamed. A dreadful sound. Temeraire hunched himself away from it, its wings flaring, and moaned softly. Lawrence leaned forward and stretched himself fully against his neck, stroking over and over.
"Do not look, my dear," he said,
the words struggling to come through the thickening of his throat.
"It will be over in a moment."
Precursorus screamed once more at the end. Then he fell to the ground heavily, as if all vital force had gone from his body. Lenton signalled that they might go, and Lawrence touched Temeraire's side.
"Away, away," he said,
and Temeraire launched himself far from the scaffold at once, striking out over the clean, empty sea.
"Lawrence, may I bring Maximus over here, and Lily?"
Berkeley asked in his usual abrupt way, having come upon him without warning.
"Your clearing is big enough, I think."
Lawrence raised his head and stared at him dully. Temeraire was still huddled in misery, head hidden beneath his wings, inconsolable. They had flown for hours, just the two of them and the ocean below, until Lawrence had at last begged him to turn back to land, out of fear that he would become exhausted. He himself felt almost bruised and ill, as if feverish. He had attended at hangings before, a grim reality of naval life, and Choiseul had been far more deserving of the fate than many a man Lawrence had seen at the end of a rope. He could not say why he felt such anguish now.
"If you like," he said, without enthusiasm,
letting his head sink again. He did not look up at the rush of wings and shadows as Maximus came over the clearing, his enormous bulk blotting out the sun until he landed heavily beside Temeraire. Lily followed after him. They huddled at once around each other and Temeraire. After a few moments Temeraire unwound himself enough to entwine more thoroughly with them both, and Lily spread her great wings over them all. Berkeley led Harcourt over to where Lawrence sat, leaning against Temeraire's side, and pushed her unresisting to sit beside him. He lowered his stout frame awkwardly to the ground opposite them, and handed about a dark bottle. Lawrence took it and drank without curiosity, strong, unwatered rum, and he had not eaten anything all day. It went to his head very quickly, and he was glad for the muffling of all sensation. Harcourt began to weep after a little while, and Lawrence was horrified to find his own face wet even as he reached to grip her shoulder.
"He was a traitor?"
"'Nothing but a lying traitor,' Harcourt said, scrubbing tears away with the back of her hand. "'I am not sorry in the least. I am not sorry at all.'
She spoke with an effort, as though she were trying to convince herself. Berkeley handed her the bottle again.
"'It is not him. Damned rotter. Deserved it,' he said. "'You are sorry on account of the dragon. And so are they. They don't think much of king and country, you know. Precursorus never knew a damned thing about it, but where Choiseul told him to go.'
"'Tell me,' Lawrence said abruptly, "'would Bonaparte have really executed the dragon for treason?'
"'Likely enough. The Continentals do, once in a great while. More to scare the riders off the notion than because they blame the beasts,' Berkeley said.
Lawrence was sorry to have asked, sorry to know that Choiseul had been telling the truth so far, at least.
"'Surely the corps would have granted him shelter in the colonies if he had asked,' he said angrily. "'There is still no possible excuse.' He desired his place in France restored. He was willing to risk Precursorus to have it back, for we might just as easily have chosen to put his dragon to death.
Berkeley shook his head.
"'Knew we are too hard up for breeders to do as much,' he said. "'Not to excuse the fellow. I dare say you are right. He thought Bonaparte was going to roll us up, and he did not like to go and live in the colonies.'
Berkeley shrugged.
"'Still damned hard on the dragon, and he has not done anything wrong.'
"'That is not true.' "'He has,' Temeraire put in unexpectedly, and they looked up at him. Maximus and Lily raised their heads as well to listen. "'Choiseul could not have forced him to fly away from France, nor to come here bent on hurting us. It does not seem to me that he is any less guilty at all.'
"'I suppose it is likely he did not understand what was being asked of him,' Harcourt said tentatively to this challenge.
Temeraire said, "'Then he ought to have refused until he did understand. "'He is not simple, like Volley. "'He might have saved his rider's life, then, and his honour, too. "'I would be ashamed to let my rider be executed, and not me, too, "'if I had done as much,' he added venomously, his tail lashing the air. "'And I would not let anyone execute Lawrence anyway. "'I should like to see them try.'
"'Maximus and Lily both rumbled in agreement.'
"'I will never let Berkeley commit treason, ever,' Maximus said. "'But if he did, I would step on anyone who tried to hang him.'
"'I would just take Catherine and go away, I think,' Lily said. "'But perhaps Precursorus would have liked to do the same. "'I suppose he could not break all those chains, for he is smaller than either of you, and he cannot spray. "'Also there was only one of him, and he was being guarded. "'I do not know what I would do if I could not have escaped.'
She finished softly, and they all began to slump down in fresh misery, huddling together again, until Temeraire stopped and said with sudden decision,
"'I will tell you what we shall do. If ever you need to rescue Catherine, or you, Berkeley, Maximus, I will help you, and you will do as much for me. Then we do not need to worry. I do not suppose anyone could stop all three of us, at least not before we could escape.'
All three of them appeared immeasurably cheered by this excellent scheme. Lawrence was now regretting the amount of rum he had consumed, for he could not properly form the protest he felt had to be made, and urgently.
"'Enough of that, you damned conspirators! You will have us hanged a great deal sooner than we will,'
Berkeley said, thankfully, on his behalf.
"'Will you have something to eat now? We're not going to eat until you do, and if you are so busy to protect us, you may as well begin by saving us from starvation.'
"'I do not think you are in any danger of starving,'
Maximus said.
"'The surgeon said only 2 weeks ago that you are too fat.'
"'The devil!'
Berkeley said indignantly, sitting up, and Maximus snorted in amusement at having provoked him. But shortly the three dragons did allow themselves to be persuaded to take some food, and Maximus and Lily returned to their own clearings to be fed.
"'I am still sorry for Precursoris, even though he acted badly,' Temeraire said presently, having finished his meal. I do not see why they could not let Choiseul go off to the colonies with him.
There must be a price for such things, or else men would do them more often. And in any case, he deserved to be punished for it,
Lawrence said. His own head had cleared with some food and strong coffee.
Choiseul meant to make Lily suffer as much as Precursorus does. Only imagine if the French had me prisoner, and demanded that you fly for them against your friends and former comrades to save my life.
Yes. "'I do see,' Temeraire said, but with dissatisfaction in his tone. "'Yet it still seems to me they might have punished him differently. Would it not have been better to keep him a prisoner and force Precursoris to fly for us?
I see you have a nice sense of the appropriate, Lawrence said. But I do not know that I can see any lesser punishment for treason. It is too despicable a crime to be punished by mere imprisonment.
And yet Precursoris is not to be punished the same way, only because it is not practical, and he is needed for breeding, Temeraire said.
Lawrence considered the matter and could not find an answer for this.
I suppose, in all honesty, being aviators ourselves, we cannot like the idea of putting a dragon to death, and so we have found an excuse for letting him live, he said finally. And as our laws are meant for men, perhaps it is not wholly fair to enforce them upon him.
Oh, that I can well agree with, Temeraire said. Some of the laws which I have heard make very little sense, and I do not know that I would obey them if it were not to oblige you. It seems to me that if you wish to apply laws to us, it were only reasonable to consult us on them, and from what you have read to me about Parliament, I do not think any dragons are invited to go there.
Next you will cry out against taxation without representation and throw a basket of tea into the harbour, Lawrence said. You are indeed a very Jacobin at heart, and I think I must give up trying to cure you of it. I can but wash my hands and deny responsibility.
Chapter 12 By the next morning, Precursoris had already gone, sent away to a dragon transport launching from Portsmouth for the small covert in Nova Scotia, whence he would be led to Newfoundland, and at last immured in the breeding grounds which had lately been started there. Lawrence had avoided any further sight of the stricken dragon, and deliberately had kept Temeraire awake late the night before, so that he would sleep past the moment of departure. Lenton had chosen his time as wisely as he could. The general, rejoicing over the victory at Trafalgar, continued, and served to counter the private unhappiness to some extent. That very day a display of fireworks was announced by pamphlets to be held over the mouth of the Thames, and Lily, Temeraire, and Maximus, being the youngest of the dragons at the covert and the worst affected, were sent to observe by Lenton's orders. Lawrence was deeply grateful for the word as the brilliant displays lit the sky and the music from the barges drifted to them across the water. Temeraire's eyes were wide with excitement, the bright bursts of colour reflecting in his pupils and his scales, and he cocked his head first one way, then another, in an effort to hear more clearly. He talked of nothing but the music, and the explosions, and the lights, all the way back to the covert.
"Is that a concert, then, the sort they have in Dover?" he asked. "Lawrence, cannot we go again, and perhaps a little closer next time? I could sit very quietly, and I would not disturb anyone."
I'm afraid fireworks such as those are a special occasion, my dear. Concerts are only music, Lawrence said, avoiding an answer. He could well imagine the reaction of the city's inhabitants to a dragon's coming to take in a concert.
Oh, Temeraire said, but he was not greatly dampened. I would still like that extremely. I could not hear very well tonight.
I do not know that there is any suitable accommodation which could be made in the city, Lawrence said slowly and reluctantly. But happily a sudden inspiration came to him, and he added, "But perhaps I can hire some musicians to come to the covert and play for you instead. That would be a great deal more comfortable in any case."
"Yes, indeed, that would be splendid," Temeraire said eagerly.
He communicated this idea to Maximus and Lily as soon as they had all once again landed, and the two of them professed equal interest.
"Damn you, Lawrence, you had much better learn to say no. You will be forever getting us into these absurd starts," Berkeley said. "Just see if any musicians will come here, for love or money." "For love, perhaps not. But for a week's wages and a hearty meal, I'm quite certain most musicians could be persuaded to play in the heart of Bedlam," Lawrence said.
"It sounds a fine idea to me," Harcourt said. "I would quite like it myself. I have not been to a concert, except once when I was 16. I had to put on skirts for it, and after only half an hour a dreadful fellow sat next to me and whispered impolite remarks until I poured a pot of coffee into his lap. It quite spoiled my pleasure, even though he went away straight after."
"Christ above, Harcourt! If I ever have reason to offend you, I'll make damn sure you have nothing hot at hand," Berkeley said,
while Lawrence struggled between nearly equal portions of dismay at her having been subjected to such insult and at her means of repulsion.
"Well, I would have struck him, but I would have had to get up.
You have no notion how difficult it is to arrange skirts when sitting down. It took me 5 minutes together the first time, she said reasonably, so I did not want to have it all to do again. Then the waiter came by, and I thought that would be easier, and anyway, more like something a girl ought to do.
Still a little pale with the notion, Lawrence bade them good night and took Temeraire off to his rest. He slept once again in the small tent by his side, even though he thought Temeraire was well over his distress, and was rewarded in the morning by being woken early, Temeraire peering into the tent with one great eye, and inquiring if perhaps Lawrence would like to go to Dover and arrange for the concert today.
"I would like to sleep until a civilized hour, but as that is evidently not to be, perhaps I will ask leave of Lenton to go,"
Lawrence said, yawning as he crawled from the tent.
"May I have my breakfast first?"
"Oh, certainly," Temeraire said, with an air of generosity.
Muttering a little, Lawrence pulled his coat back on and began to walk back to the headquarters. Halfway to the building he nearly collided with Morgan, running to find him.
"Sir, Admiral Lenton wants you,"
the boy said, panting with excitement when Lawrence had steadied him.
"And he says Temeraire is to go into combat rig."
"Very good," Lawrence said, concealing his surprise. "Go tell Lieutenant Granby and Mr. Horan at once, and then do as Lieutenant Granby tells you. Mind you speak of this to no one else."
"Yes, sir,"
the boy said, and dashed off again to the barracks. Lawrence quickened his pace.
"Come in, Lawrence,"
Lenton said in reply to his knock. It seemed that every other captain in the covert was already crowded into the office as well. To Lawrence's surprise, Rankin was at the front of the room, sitting by Lenton's desk. By wordless agreement, they had managed to avoid speaking to one another since Rankin's transfer from Lochlagan, and Lawrence had known nothing of his and Levitas's activities. These had evidently been more dangerous than Lawrence might have imagined. A bandage round Rankin's thigh was visibly stained with blood, and his clothes also. His thin face was pale and set with pain. Lenton waited only until the door had closed behind the last few stragglers to begin. He said grimly,
"I dare say you already realize, gentlemen, we have been celebrating too soon. Captain Rankin has just returned from a flight over the coast. He was able to slip past their borders and caught a look at what that damned Corsican has been working on. You may see for yourselves."
He pushed across his desk a sheet of paper, smudged with dirt and blood-stains, that did not obscure an elegantly drafted diagram in Rankin's precise hand. Lawrence frowned, trying to puzzle the thing out. It looked rather like a ship of the line, but with no railings at all around her upper deck and no masts shipped, with strange thick beams protruding from both sides, fore and aft, and no gun ports.
"What is it for?" Chenery said, turning it around. "I thought he already had boats."
"Perhaps it will become clearer if I explain that he had dragons carrying them about over the ground," Rankin said.
Lawrence understood at once. The beams were intended to give the dragons a place to hold. Napoleon meant to fly his troops over the Navy's guns entirely, while so many of Britain's aerial forces were occupied at the Mediterranean. Lenton said,
"We are not certain how many men he will have in each." "Sir, I beg your pardon. May I ask, how long are these vessels?"
Lawrence asked, interrupting.
"And is this to scale?"
"To my eye, yes," Rankin said. "The one which I saw in mid-air had two reapers to a side and room to spare, perhaps 200 feet from front to back."
"There will be 3 deckers inside, then," Lawrence said grimly. "If they sling hammocks, he can fit as many as 2,000 men apiece for a short journey, if he means to carry no provisions."
A murmur of alarm went around the room. Lenton said,
"Less than 2 hours to cross each way, even if they launch from Cherbourg, and he has 60 dragons or more."
"He could land 50,000 men by mid-morning, good God,"
said one of the captains Lawrence did not know, a man who had arrived only recently. The same calculation was running in all their heads. It was impossible not to look about the room and tally their own side. Less than 20 men, a good quarter of whom were the scout and courier captains whose beasts could do very little in combat.
"But surely the things must be hopeless to manage in the air. And can the dragons carry such a weight?"
Sutton asked, studying the design further.
"Likely he has built them from light wood. He only needs them to last a day, after all, and they need not be watertight,"
Lawrence said.
"He needs only an easterly wind to carry him over. With that narrow framing they will offer very little resistance. But they will be vulnerable in the air, and surely Exidium and Mortiferous are already on their way back."
4 days away at best, and Bonaparte must know that as well as we do," Lenton said.
He has spent nearly his entire fleet, and the Spanish as well, to buy himself freedom from their presence. He is not going to waste the chance.
The obvious truth of this was felt at once. A grim and expectant silence fell upon the room. Lenton looked down at his desk, then stood up, uncharacteristically slow. Lawrence, for the first time, noticed that his hair was grey and thin.
"Gentlemen," Lenton said formally, "the wind is in the north today, so we may have a little grace if he chooses to wait for a better wind. All of our scouts will be flying in shifts just off Cherbourg. We will have an hour's warning, at least. I do not need to tell you we will be hopelessly outnumbered. We can only do our best, and delay if we cannot prevent."
No one spoke, and after a moment he said,
"We will need every heavy and middleweight beast on independent duty. Your task will be to destroy these transports. Chennery, Warren, the two of you will take mid-wing positions in Lily's formation, and two of our scouts will take the wing-tip positions. Captain Harcourt, undoubtedly Bonaparte will reserve some dragons for defence. Your task is to keep those defenders occupied as best you can."
"Yes, sir," she said. The others nodded. Lenton took a deep breath and rubbed his face.
"There is nothing else to be said, gentlemen. Go to your preparations."
There was no sense in keeping it from the men. The French had nearly caught Rankin on his way back, and already knew that their secret at last was out. Lawrence quietly told his lieutenants, then sent them about their work. He could see the passage of the news through the ranks, men leaning in to hear from one another, their faces hardening as they grasped the situation, and the ordinary idle conversation of a morning vanishing quite away. He was proud to see even the youngest officers take it with great courage and go straight back to their work. This was the first time Temeraire would ever use the complete accoutrement of heavy combat outside of practice. For patrol, a much lighter set of gear was used, and their previous engagement had been under travelling harness. Temeraire stood very straight and still, only his head turned about so he could watch with great excitement as the men rigged him out with the heaviest leather harness triple riveted and began hooking in the enormous panels of chain mesh that would serve as armour. Lawrence began his own inspection of the equipment, and belatedly realised that Hollin was nowhere to be seen. He looked three times through the whole clearing before he quite believed the man's absence, and then called the armourer Pratt away from his work on the great protective plates which would shield Temeraire's breast and shoulders during the fighting.
"Where is Mr. Hollin?" he asked.
"Why, I don't believe I've seen him this morning, sir," Pratt said, scratching his head. "He was in last night, though."
"Very good," Lawrence said, and dismissed him. "Roland, Dyer, Morgan," he called, and when the three runners came, he said, "Go and see if you can find Mr. Hollin, and then tell him I expect him here at once, if you please."
"Yes, sir," they said almost in unison, and dashed off in different directions after a hurried consultation. He returned to watching the men work, a deep frown on his face. He was astonished and dismayed to find the man failing in his duty at all, and under these circumstances most particularly. He wondered if Hollin could have fallen ill and gone to the surgeons. It seemed the only excuse, but the man would surely have told one of his crewmates. More than an hour went by, and Temeraire was in full rig with the crew practising boarding manoeuvres under Lieutenant Granby's severe eye, before young Roland came hurrying back to the clearing.
"Sir," she said, panting and unhappy. "Sir, Mr. Hollin is with Levitas. Please do not be angry," she said, all in one rushing breath.
"Ah," Lawrence said, a little embarrassed. He could hardly admit to Roland that he had been turning a blind eye to Hollin's visits, so she naturally was reluctant to be a tale-bearer on a fellow aviator.
"You will have to answer for it, but that can wait. Go and tell him he is needed at once."
"Sir, I told him so, but he said he cannot leave Levitas, and he told me to go away at once and to tell you that he begs you to come if only you can,"
she said very quickly, and eyeing him nervously to see how he would take this insubordination. Lawrence stared. He could not account for the extraordinary response, but after a moment his estimate of Hollin's character decided him.
"Mr. Granby," he called, "I must go for a moment. I leave things in your hands. Roland, stay here and come fetch me at once if anything occurs," he told her.
He walked quickly, torn between temper and concern, and reluctance to once again expose himself to a complaint from Rankin, particularly under the circumstances. No one could deny the man had done his duty bravely just now, and to offer him insult directly after would be an extraordinary piece of rudeness. And at the same time Lawrence could not help but grow angry at the man as he followed Roland's directions. Levitas's clearing was one of the small ones nearest the headquarters, undoubtedly chosen for Rankin's convenience rather than his dragon's. The grounds were poorly tended, and when Levitas came into view, Lawrence saw he was lying in a circle of bare, sandy dirt, with his head in Holland's lap.
"Well, Mr. Holland, what's all this?"
Lawrence said, irritation making his tone sharp. Then he came around and saw the great expanse of bandages that covered Levitas's flank and belly, hidden from the other side, and already soaked through with the near black blood.
"My God!" he said involuntarily.
Levitas's eyes opened a little at the sound, and turned up to look at him hopefully. They were glazed and bright with pain, but after a moment recognition came into them, and the little dragon sighed and closed them again without a word.
"Sir," Holland said, "I'm sorry, I know I've my duty, but I couldn't leave him. The surgeon's gone, says there's nothing more to be done for him, and it won't be long. There is no one here at all, not even to send for some water."
He stopped and said again,
"I couldn't leave him."
Lawrence knelt beside him and put his hand on Levitas's head, very lightly for fear of causing him more pain.
"No," he said, "of course not."
He was glad now to find himself so close to the headquarters. There were some crewmen idling by the door talking of the news, so he could send them to Holland's assistance, and Rankin was in the officers' club, easily found. He was drinking wine, his colour already greatly improved, and having shifted his blood-stained clothing for fresh. Lenton and a couple of the scout captains were sitting with him and discussing positions to hold along the coastline. Coming up to him, Lawrence told him very quietly, "If you can walk, get on your feet. Otherwise I will carry you." Rankin put down his glass and stared at him coldly.
"I beg your pardon," he said. "I gather this is some more of your officious—"
Lawrence paid no attention, but seized the back of his chair and heaved. Rankin fell forward, scrabbling to catch himself on the floor. Lawrence took him by the scruff of his coat and dragged him up to his feet, ignoring his gasp of pain.
"Lawrence, what in God's name?"
Lenton said in astonishment, rising to his feet.
"Levitas is dying. Captain Rankin wishes to make his farewells," Lawrence said,
looking Lenton squarely in the eye and holding Rankin up by the collar and the arm.
"He begs to be excused."
The other captains stared, half out of their chairs. Lenton looked at Rankin, then very deliberately sat back down again.
"Very good,"
he said, and reached for the bottle. The other captains slowly sank back down as well. Rankin stumbled along in his grip, not even trying to free himself, shrinking a little from Lawrence as they went. Outside the clearing, Lawrence stopped and faced him.
"You will be generous to him, do you understand me?" he said. "You will give him every word of praise he has earned from you and never received. You will tell him he has been brave and loyal, and a better partner than you have deserved."
Rankin said nothing, only stared as if Lawrence were a dangerous lunatic. Lawrence shook him again.
"By God, you will do all this and more, and hope that it is enough to satisfy me," he said savagely, and dragged him on.
Holland was still sitting with Levitas's head in his lap, a bucket now beside him. He was squeezing water from a clean cloth into the dragon's open mouth. He looked at Rankin without bothering to hide his contempt, but then he bent over and said,
"Levitas, come along now. Look who's come."
Levitas's eyes opened, but they were milky and blind.
"My captain?"
he said uncertainly. Lawrence thrust Rankin forward and down onto his knees, none too gently. Rankin gasped and clutched at his thigh, but he said,
"Yes, I am here."
He looked up at Lawrence and swallowed, then added awkwardly, "You have been very brave." There was nothing natural or sincere in the tone. It was as ungraceful as could be imagined. But Levitas only said, very softly,
"You came."
He licked at a few drops of water at the corner of his mouth. The blood was still welling sluggishly from beneath the dressing, thick enough to slightly part the bandages one from the other, glistening and black. Rankin shifted uneasily. His breeches and stockings were being soaked through, but he looked up at Lawrence and did not try to move away. Levitas gave a low sigh, and then the shallow movement of his sides ceased. Holland closed his eyes with one rough hand. Lawrence's hand was still heavy on the back of Rankin's neck. Now he lifted it away, rage gone, and only tight-lipped disgust left.
"Go," he said. "We, who valued him, will make the arrangements, not you."
He did not even look at the man as Rankin left the clearing.
"I cannot stay," he said quietly to Hollin. "Can you manage?" "Yes," Hollin said, stroking the little head. "There can't be anything, with a battle coming and all, but I'll see he's taken and buried proper. Thank you, sir. It meant a great deal to him." "More than it ought," Lawrence said.
He stood looking down at Levitas a short while longer, and then he went back to the headquarters and found Admiral Lenton.
"Well," Lenton said, scowling as Lawrence was shown into his office.
"Sir, I apologize for my behavior," Lawrence said. "I'm happy to bear any consequences you should think appropriate."
"No, no, what are you talking about? I mean Levitas," Lenton said impatiently.
Lawrence paused, then said, "Dead, with a great deal of pain. But he went easily at the end."
Lenton shook his head.
"Damned pity," he said, pouring a glass of brandy for Lawrence and himself.
He finished his own glass in two great swallows and sighed heavily.
"And a wretched time for Rankin to become unharnessed," he said. "We have a Winchester hatching unexpectedly at Chatham, any day now by the hardening of the shell. I have been scrambling to find a fellow in range worthy of the position and willing to be put to a Winchester. Now here he is on the loose and having made himself a hero bringing us this news. If I don't send him and the beast ends up unharnessed, we will have a yowl from his entire damned family, and a question taken up in Parliament like as not."
"I would rather see a dragon dead than in his hands," Lawrence said, setting down his glass hard.
"Sir, if you want a man who will be a credit to the service, send Mr. Hollin. I would vouch with my life for him."
"What, your ground crewmaster?"
Lenton frowned at him, but thoughtfully.
"That is a thought. If you think him suited for the task, he could not feel he was hurting his career by such a step. Not a gentleman, I suppose."
"No, sir, unless by gentleman you mean a man of honour rather than breeding," Lawrence said.
Lenton snorted at this.
"Well, we're not so stiff-necked a lot we must pay that a great deal of mind," he said. "I dare say it will answer nicely, if we are not all dead or captured by the time the egg cracks, at any rate."
Hollin stared when Lawrence relieved him of his duties and said a little helplessly,
"My own dragon?"
He had to turn away and hide his face. Lawrence pretended not to see.
"Sir, I don't know how to thank you,"
he said, whispering to keep his voice from breaking.
"I have promised you will be a credit to the service. See to it you do not make me a liar, and I will be content,"
Lawrence said, and shook his hand.
"You must go at once. The hatching is expected at almost any day, and there is a carriage waiting to take you to Chatham."
Looking dazed, Hollin accepted Lawrence's hand and the bag with his few possessions which his fellows on the ground crew had hastily packed for him, then allowed himself to be led off towards the waiting carriage by young Dyer. The crew were beaming upon him as they went. He was obliged to shake a great many hands until Lawrence, fearing he would never get under way, said,
"Gentlemen, the wind is still in the north. Let us get some of this armour off Temeraire for the night,"
and put them to work. Temeraire watched him go a little sadly.
"I am very glad that the new dragon will have him instead of Rankin, but I wish they had given him to Levitas sooner, and perhaps Hollin would have kept him from dying," he said to Lawrence as the crew worked on him.
"We cannot know what would have happened," Lawrence said, "but I am not certain Levitas could ever have been happy with such an exchange. Even at the end he only wanted Rankin's affection, as strange as that seems to us."
Lawrence slept with Temeraire again that evening, close and sheltered in his arms, and wrapped in several woolen blankets against the early frost. He woke just before first light to see the barren treetops bending away from the sunrise, an easterly wind blowing from France.
"Temeraire," he called quietly,
and the great head rose up above him to sniff the air.
"The wind has changed," Temeraire said, and bent down to nuzzle him.
Lawrence allowed himself the indulgence of 5 minutes, lying warm and embraced, with his hands resting on the narrow, tender scales of Temeraire's nose.
"I hope I have never given you cause for unhappiness, my dear," he said softly.
"Never, Lawrence," Temeraire said, very low.
The ground crew came hurrying from the barracks the moment he touched the bell. The chain mesh had been left in the clearing under a cloth, and Temeraire had slept in the heavy harness for this once. He was quickly fitted out, while at the other side of the clearing grandly reviewed every man's harness and carabiners. Lawrence submitted to his inspection as well, then took a moment to clean and reload his pistols fresh and belt on his sword. The sky was cold and white, a few darker grey clouds scudding like shadows. No orders had come yet. At Lawrence's request, Temeraire lifted him up to his shoulder and reared onto his hind legs. He could see the dark line of the ocean past the trees, and the ships bobbing in the harbour. The wind came strongly into his face, cold and salt.
"Thank you, Temeraire," he said,
and Temeraire set him down again.
"Mr. Granby, we will get the crew aboard," Lawrence said.
The ground crew put up a great noise, more a roar than a cheer, as Temeraire rose into the air. Lawrence could hear it echoed throughout the cover as the other great beasts beat up into the sky. Maximus was a great blazing presence in his red-gold brilliance, dwarfing the others. Victoriatus and Lily also stood out against the crowd of smaller, yellow reapers. Lenten's flag was streaming from his dragon Obversaria, the golden angle wing. She was only a little larger than the reapers, but she cut through the crowd of dragons and took the lead with effortless grace, her wings rotating almost as did Temeraire's. As the larger dragons had been set on independent duty, Temeraire did not need to keep to the formation's speed. He quickly negotiated a position near the leading edge of the force. The wind was in their faces, cold and damp, and the low whistling shriek of their passage carried away all noise, leaving only the leathery snap of Temeraire's wings, each beat like a sail going taut, and the creaking of the harness. Nothing else broke the unnatural, heavy silence of the crew. They were already drawn in sight. At this distance the French dragons seemed a cloud of gulls or sparrows, so many were they, and wheeling so in unison.